Hello, and welcome to an author debriefing from the International Spy Museum. I'm Mark Stout, the museum's historian. Here at the museum, we get the most interesting authors, including journalists, scholars, former spies, and intelligence officers, coming in to speak with our visitors and answer questions about their latest works dealing with espionage, intelligence, and other national security issues. Please join me in listening to another of our selected hour-long author debriefings. Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the International Spy Museum. I'm Mark Stout, the historian here, and I'm very pleased today to announce that we have speaking Randall B. Woods, who's the John A. Cooper Distinguished Professor of History at the University of Arkansas. He's not only a professor there at Arkansas, but previously, if I understand correctly, has been the Dean of Arts and Sciences as well. So congratulations on getting back into actually doing real academic work. Professor Woods has published numerous books, including Fulbright, a biography, which came out in 1995 and which was nominated both for the Pulitzer Prize and also the National Book Award, and which won the Farrell and Ledbetter Prizes. More recently, he's the author in 2006 of LBJ, Architect of American Ambition. But today we're here to talk about his latest book, just out on April 9th, I believe, Shadow Warrior, William Egan Colby and the CIA. Now, William Colby is one of several CIA directors. The last was William Casey, of course, who were OSS veterans. But despite coming from the OSS, from that very core of the CIA tradition and of CIA mythology, if you will, Colby is also one of the more controversial figures in CIA history. Many people in the agency and the intelligence world love him, and many others loathed him. So this is the contradiction, I think, at the core of Randall Woods' book. So to elucidate this further, let's hear from the author himself. Ladies and gentlemen, Randall Woods.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here at the very heart of spookdom and the Spy Museum. What a great place for a little talk on Bill Colby, although Bill Colby wasn't really a spy. He did a little traditional espionage work and ran some agents when he was in Scandinavia in the early part of the Cold War. He was in Italy in the 1950s, but specialized there in political warfare. Bill Colby, as you probably know, is most closely associated with covert operations, psychological warfare, political warfare, counterinsurgency, and pacification. That was a function of the fact that that he was a certified commando hero during World War II. He was a Jedburgh. Joined the OSS in 1943, and in 1944 dropped behind enemy lines in France and helped to raise the Maquis, the resistance, which helped to facilitate George Patton's sweep across southern France, and then dropped into Norway and with his commando team blew up two bridges, which helped keep 140,000 German troops bottled up in Norway, where they were unable to reach Germany for the last fight. He's quite explicit about the fact that that his experiences as an OSS commando created in him an appreciation, even a love for covert operations, for secret armies, for nation building. For what came to be known as counterinsurgency and pacification. But the roots went back further than that. Colby's father, Elbridge, was a career army, but also had a PhD in literature. And Elbridge was a sixth-generation New Englander. Bill Colby was an only son, and when they weren't on some army base, they lived in New England in and around Vermont. And Elbridge was a great student of guerrilla warfare during the French and Indian War and during the Revolutionary War, particularly of Rogers Rangers, which was a colonial guerrilla force which fought with the English during the French and Indian War. As an only child, Bill spent a lot of time with his father, a great deal of time with his father, and I think absorbed some of his fascination, that he got some of his fascination with unconventional warfare through his father's interest, which were reinforced by his OSS experience. Colby was a Princeton graduate, although instead of belonging to an eating club in one of the eating clubs at Princeton, he waited tables at eating clubs at Princeton. He was his college activities had more to do with becoming commander of the ROTC and serving as an altar boy in the Catholic Church there. His mother was an Irish Catholic. His father was converted to Catholicism when he was in college. Colby enlisted after the war began. OSS came back after the war and graduated from Columbia Law School. Practiced labor law. He was a New Deal liberal, practiced law. Ironically, he was became a member of William Donovan's law firm. In New York, Donovan, a lifelong Republican, as were most of his partners, but he believed in political diversity, and so hired Bill Colby. And Colby was very proud of the fact that he was one of Donovan's proteges. Colby became bored with the prospect of earning a great deal of money as a corporate lawyer. And when the CIA approached him in 1950, he readily joined. Colby was one of those folks who readily made the psychological transition from viewing Hitler and National Socialism viewing Stalinism and Soviet communism as a threat to national security and democracy and liberalism as great a threat as Hitler and National Socialism. There was never any, I don't think, any second guessing about his commitment to being a cold warrior. But he believed that the conflict between liberal capitalism and Stalinism, Soviet communism, was a conflict that was going to be fought out in the halls of power in the countrysides of the world, not simply a matter of treaties and arsenals and armed confrontation. From the very his first assignment was in Scandinavia. He thought he would be assigned to Asia, because when he lived, Bill Colby lived with his family in Tientsin, China, between 1929 and 1932. His father was assigned there with the 15th Rifles. Bill spent the years between the time he was 10 and 12 in this very cosmopolitan international concession in Tientsin. And he learned some Chinese at that point. He listed his OSS records list Chinese as one of his languages. I'm not so sure about that, but he had some language, but he had some experience there, and he thought he would be assigned to China, but he was, because of his commando experience in Norway, he was assigned to Scandinavia, and there he was involved with creating stay behind units in anticipation of a Soviet conquest of Scandinavia. The CIA created would-be guerrilla operations, espionage operations, complete with arms catches. He ran some agents dropped some agents into occupied Eastern Europe with disastrous results. He was assigned to Scandinavia, as you know, is on the periphery, really, of the Cold War. The real center of action was Berlin, and the closer you could get to Berlin, the hotter the more the action. So he was assigned to. He was glad to be assigned to the Rome station and served there, I think, from 52 to 58, 53 to 58. He especially there was political action. He and Thomas McCoy spent a great deal of time funneling large sums of money to the Christian Democrats and to other anti-communist factions there. Probably the most important, in terms of biography, the most important aspect of his time there was he became involved in although they were rumored to have had an affair. The ambassador was Claire Booth Luce, the wife of Henry Luce, staunch Republican, conservative. In the struggle for control of Italian politics, Colby and his supporters wanted to make an opening to the left. They wanted to see an alliance created between the Christian Democrats and the socialists to split the socialists off from the communists. Luce and John Foster Dulles, other folks there, James Angleton, who was involved in Italy at that point, were absolutely opposed to that. They'd rather make an alliance with the monarchists and with radical anti-communists within the Vatican. This was a reflection of a much more important debate that was going on within the Eisenhower administration, and that would continue into the Kennedy administration. But Colby clearly, that's significant because it points to the fact that Colby didn't really have an ideological edge, despite the fact that he was willing to sacrifice everything in the international struggle against communism. It had to do more with security and anti-totalitarianism rather than socioeconomics. He wasn't particularly concerned about Marxism, Leninism. He was concerned about Stalinism and totalitarianism and police states and that sort of thing, which put him somewhat at odds with the hardcore right wing. You see in Italy the beginning of the lifelong conflict and rivalry between James Jesus Angleton, espionage, counter-espionage, a hardline ideological anti-communist, and Colby, much more pragmatic, much more politically liberal, two different political philosophies. Colby appreciated espionage and counter-espionage, but he believed that the CIA ought to pay at least equal attention to psychological warfare, to political conflict, and in areas like Laos and Vietnam, counterinsurgency and pacification. In 1959, he finally got his wish to go to Asia, and he was assistant station chief in Saigon, became assistant station chief in Saigon in 1959. Quickly, and by 1960, he was station chief. He became really an intimate of the Ngo brothers, Ngo Dinh Nim and Ngo Dinh Nu, particularly Nu. He found Nu fascinating, an intellectual, Ziem much more rigid, much more otherworldly. But he believed, and he remained committed to these two men. He thought, and of course they were all Catholics, which didn't hurt. But he believed that they were probably South Vietnam's best chance for creating a viable society that was capable of standing on its own two feet and resisting communism. He was much opposed to the coup that overthrew them. And he lamented the fact that there would never be another civilian regime in South Vietnam. He saw the militarization of South Vietnamese politics as a disaster. While he was stationed chief, he did a number of things, but he's best known for creating a counterinsurgency and pacification program among the Montagnards, the mountain people, specifically one of the many tribes, the Rade, there. His idea was that the Rade were being harassed by both the South Vietnamese and by the Vietnamese communists. Colby and his team there began to organize the villagers, and with the permission of the South reluctant permission of the South Vietnamese government, to arm them. So, in the belief that if these people could be enabled to arm and themselves and defend their families and their own villages, this would have security benefits, but also give them a sense of community, a sense of self-control, self-direction, which he believed was the key to creating a South Vietnam that could successfully fend off communism. After he left and to come back to the States in 62, the program that he had created with the Rade, called Civilian Defense Irregular Group, became the basis for Strategic Hamlets, which have gotten very mixed reviews among historians. But Strategic Hamlets weren't being run by the CIA and by Bill Colby. They were being run by the Ngo brothers and by the South Vietnamese intelligence service, who viewed the Rade and other tribes as savages. So it was a much different operation. But between 62 and 68, Bill Colby was head of the 4-H Division in the operations department in the CIA. And he continued to oversee what was going on in Vietnam, but famously also was the architect of the secret war in Laos, in which CIA operatives created what is supposed to be the largest clandestine army in modern history. They armed and trained, eventually began with some 9,000 Hmong tribesmen, wound up about nearly 60,000. And the Hmong were armed and supplied by Air America, trained by CIA folks. They lived in villages 4,000 feet above, and they would raid and harass the VC, interdict the traffic on the increasing volume of traffic on the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Colby thought that the secret war in Laos was the model for combating communism in the Third World. He was absolutely opposed to the escalation of the war in Vietnam. I shouldn't say that. I mean, he understood that if the U.S. had not stepped in and escalated, intervened in 64 and 65, that Vietnam, South Vietnam, would have fallen to the communists. Once NVA troops began coming down the Ho Chi Minh Trail in April of 1964, it changed everything. I talked to CIA people there, other people. They were already requesting new assignments. South Vietnam was gone. He understood the necessity, but he believed that the U.S. militarily should have just gotten South Vietnam on its feet and then gotten out. But the search and destroy, the massive sweep movements, the free fire zones, he believed were counterproductive. That in the end you might be killing communists, but you're creating more such chaos and havoc. You were creating more recruits for the enemy than you were killing them. He believed that the way to fight communism in the developing world was the model in Laos, in which the U.S. had a very light footprint, very light hand. And you empower the locals. If you can't empower them, if they can't defend themselves, if they're not willing to defend themselves, what the hell are you going to do anyway? I mean, the only alternative is to annex the country. And formal imperialism was a dying phenomenon at that point. The U.S. wouldn't stand for that. There were people on the ground in Vietnam that Colby knew, John Paul Vann, a man named Everett Bumgardner, and other people in and out of the CIA. It's hard to tell. You know, the CIA have people who are CIA officers, and then they have case people, so they temporarily assign to them. And so it's difficult to tell. But there were a community of folks who were interested in saving South Vietnam from communism, who were active in Vietnam and in Washington, trying to persuade Lyndon Johnson to change the focus of the conflict in South Vietnam. And they began to win him over in 1966. In 1967, he named a former CIA man who was attached to the National Security Council, a man named William Comer, Bob Comer, to create a counterinsurgency and pacification organization. That organization became CORDS, which was the overarching counterinsurgency American pacification operation in Vietnam from late 67 until the end of 1972. In 1968, Colby, right after Tet began, Colby went to Vietnam, and within 6 months he became head of CORDS. CORDS was something that, as I told some of my colleagues, has not gotten much attention from historians. Most historians are very anti Vietnam and opposed to the war. Like so many people, for them, the war ended in 1968 with Tet. But we were there for 4 more years, and counterinsurgency pacification didn't really get started seriously until 1968. The two building blocks were, there was a Vietnam training center in Washington and one in Vung Tau in Vietnam. In Washington, this training facility began turning out CIA people, Foreign Service people, USIS people who could speak Vietnamese. When Colby first went to Vietnam, there were probably 25 Americans who could speak Vietnamese. Americans who went to Vietnam spoke French, the language of the French oppressors, not particularly helpful. By late 1969, there were 1,600 Americans spread out through the villages and hamlets of South Vietnam who could speak Vietnamese. Some of them were CIA, some of them were regular military officers, some of them were Foreign Service officers. The CORDS was an organization unique in American history in that it included military personnel who supervised civilians and civilians who supervised military personnel. It was Colby's dream of an organization that could deal with the communist insurgency at every level, from propaganda to ideology to small unit combat to building hospitals and schools. Notorious, if you use that would be the term to be used at the time, aspect of CORDS was the Phoenix Program. Among other things, the CORDS used CIA people and SEALs to train 59-man teams called Provincial Reconnaissance Units. I love CIA is a great talent for creating names which you can't remember because they have no meaning. They're just words. But it's the hardest thing about dealing with this. Provincial reconnaissance units. But these were counter-terror teams which using American intelligence lists going back to Lansdale that gathered on suspected communists. But the communist cadre, these were people who were both military and civilian operatives who were at the cutting edge of recruiting communists and creating insecurity in the countryside. And by by North Vietnam, by the account of the official army account of the war, the North Vietnamese army account, the Phoenix was responsible for liquidating and killing some 20,000 VC operatives. It became infamous in the United States after 1970, with the anti-war movement in full swing. The CIA really became, in the minds of those who were opposed to the war, the tip of the evil empire, the entering wedge of everything that was wrong about American foreign policy and American and the Phoenix program, which was labeled after hearings by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, my old subject Bill Fulbright, as a program of assassination. Colby had to come back and testify. He denied that this was a program of assassination. I don't know why the hell he bothered to deny it. Of course, it was a program of assassination. The Viet Cong had a terror a component called the Ban An Ninh. Some 23,000 cadre that were committed to doing that. Their sole object was to assassinate South Vietnamese village leaders, kill their families, blow up their houses. The term assassination in warfare seems to me to be absurd, but whatever it became, and of course the CIA from that point on would be plagued by the term assassination. It would live with that term. It would have to defend itself against that term. I think Colby probably made a mistake. I think he was trying to be politically astute, but I think he probably made a mistake by not challenging Fulbright and other anti-war folks on that directly. At any rate, Cords was a success. There were still massive pockets of communist influence, particularly in the Delta and along the countryside. I mean, communism wasn't dead, but in terms of creating stability and a degree of prosperity in large tracts of South Vietnam, Cords was a success. But South Vietnam was a failure. The revolution that the Cords people were bringing about in the countryside never made contact with the military government in Saigon, which was venal, corrupt, and it actually viewed what Colby and his people were doing as subversive, because they were creating a sense of self-determination. They were arming villages to defend themselves, villages which elected their own representatives. The regime in Saigon was a semi-fascist totalitarian regime. And so what Colby and these people were doing, at the same time they were fighting communists in the countryside, they were also potentially subverting the regime in Saigon. And finally, Nguyen Van Thieu called a halt. And by 1969-70, Mr. Kissinger and Mr. Nixon had decided that we needed to get out of Vietnam. And so they began to shut down the Cords and began to instruct personnel there to stay away from anti-corruption campaigns, to stop promoting economic and social justice in the countryside. It was subversive. You could see the beginning of the end. You could never do anything about the venal and corrupt government in Saigon. Couldn't really do anything about the increasing strength of the anti-war movement at home. Colby came home in 72. His oldest daughter was seriously ill. He didn't want to come home, but and she died in 73. Colby, I suppose, never left the CIA, really. And the only reason the CIA agreed to the creation of Cords was if Colby would be head of it, because there was too much overlap, too much operations that felt too threatened by that. But when he came back, he didn't have a job. He was comptroller general for a couple of years, But then when he wanted to be head of operations, and when Jim Schlesinger became DCI, Colby helped acculturate him, and he was made a director of operations. And Colby succeeded Schlesinger as DCI. Colby, I don't think that most. Colby had no political constituency. He was career CIA, and I'm not a member of the CIA, I'm a member of that culture. But my understanding is that most people in that position never really dream of becoming DCI. You think about what you would do if you were DCI, what the DCI ought to do, but it's very unusual for that to happen. I mean, Colby just wasn't that significant a figure. Some question about why Kissinger and Nixon appointed him. They appointed him, I think, because he did not have a political constituency. By that time, Nixon and Kissinger didn't trust the CIA, they didn't trust anybody, but they didn't trust the CIA. They'd begun to attack its analytical division because of it. The analytical division was increasingly critical of the strategy we were pursuing in Vietnam. They wanted everybody in the CIA to be good soldiers. They didn't want any independent advice. They wanted the CIA to shut up and do what it was told. And they thought Bill Colby would be a good soldier. He didn't have a political constituency, nobody in Congress he could go to, so he seemed to be the perfect kind of pawn, tool. And Colby would have been willing to do that. He wasn't interested in the broader political world that most DCIs operated in. He wanted to create a better agency. He wanted to create a more effective intelligence agency. He also, at the same time, wanted to he thought by that time Jim Angleton and counterintelligence were out of control. This paranoia, the mole search, every agent in the CIA in the field was under continuous investigation by Angleton's office. And Colby thought it was completely subverting the work of the Soviet and East European division, because these people were having to spend most of their time defending themselves against accusations, explicit or implicit, by CIA that they were spies. And so he wanted to rein Angleton in, control that, and he was interested in the new technological breakthroughs in espionage, satellite espionage. Still interested in counterinsurgency and pacification, though. Still a covert operative at the core. But his tenure as DCI would be consumed with the family jewels. And it's a long, convoluted story. One of Colby's problems was that when he worked for Helms and Schlesinger, Nixon and Kissinger had told them to cut the CIA by up to 20%, and Colby was the guy that was assigned to fire people. And under Colby and Schlesinger, there's a large number of people had been fired. Well, it kind of brings people's loyalty into question when they're abused like that. So there was a gathering storm. The press more than happy to make the CIA the scapegoat, the whipping boy for Vietnam and everything was wrong with American foreign policy, beginning to focus on the CIA as the evil empire. You've got people who have been abused under Helms and Schlesinger who are willing to talk. You've got Cy Hirsch, super investigative journalist in the best and worst sense of that word. And what you had then is a perfect storm and the emergence of the so-called family jewels crisis. Secrets began to leak to the press about plots to assassinate Castro, the mongoose, assassinate Trujillo in the Dominican Republic, figures in the Congo, stories about, well, Phoenix was included as part of that. Here's a massive assassination program. The news about the CIA penetration of the National Student Association. Now, at the same time this was going on, Watergate's coming out, and the Nixon White House is trying to blame the CIA for Watergate. When the CIA refused to accede to White House demands that it tell the FBI to stop investigating the Watergate because it was a threat to national security, the Nixon White House responded by trying to blame the CIA for Watergate. So you've got Colby's dealing, he's heading an agency which is under attack from the press, it's being investigated by Congress, and it's being subverted by the White House. And so as the secrets are coming out, Congress is investigating. Colby expected to be consulted by Kissinger and Ford by this time on how to deal with the matter. He was totally shut out. At that point, he realized that he was going to have to do whatever he thought was best. Now, Bill Colby was trained as a constitutional lawyer. And what he did between 75 and 76 was cooperate with Congress. He provided it with whatever information he could on past CIA activities, as long as it didn't involve methods and sources, people and specific details about operations. That's what created the split within the CIA then and now. You know, Helms and other people, Angleton, whom Colby managed to fire, believed that espionage was espionage, that the secrecy was secrecy. We didn't have a Public Secrets Act like the British, but we should have. I mean, if you don't have secrecy, if you don't have absolute secrecy, how are other intelligence units going to trust you? How can you operate? Colby believed, he understood that, but he believed that in that climate, if he was not forthcoming to a certain extent, the Congress might very well have done away with the CIA. And there was certainly talk about that. So in his mind, he was, maybe it was self-serving, he was compromising in order to save an agency which he had devoted his life to and which he loved and respected. Some agreed that that was necessary, and some agreed that it wasn't. Among those who thought that it wasn't were Henry Kissinger and Gerald Ford, and Bill Colby was fired in 1976, and he was replaced by George H.W. Bush. But let me stop there and see if you have any questions, comments, accusations, denunciations, confessions. Yes, sir.
What you're referring to as the...
Peter, I'll bring you a mic.
Thank you. Okay. What you referred to as the family jewels, and those were reports from within the agency by agency officers of anything that they regarded as might have been a form of wrongdoing. That was requested by Schlesinger,
yes.
Not by Colby.
Yes.
So the so-called family jewels, if you want to look at it as a bound volume or something,
yes.
Existed. It
yes.
Wasn't created by Colby. He didn't go yes, in and ask for that information.
Yes, sir. Yeah. It was okay. It was just his lot to deal with it.
Right.
News began to come out about past CIA wrongdoings. Mr. Schlesinger ordered an internal search. If there anything, you know, anything that you think is extra legal or it could be portrayed as extra legal, he told his subordinates, I want that all. Wanted he, and then they gathered this information and then he locked it away. But he couldn't, and then it was up to Colby to try to deal with it after those secrets. He may have locked them away, but they kept coming to light in the press, and it was up to Colby to deal with it. And also the first word of the leak about assassinations came from Gerald Ford. He had an off the record meeting with the editorial board of the New York Times, and he mentioned the term assassinations, and they said what? And he said, well, you can't use that. You can't, well, tell a newspaper person that, you know, whatever. Colby was a fireman here, really, I think.
I'll take one. So in Mark Mazzetti's book, The Way of the Knife, about today's CIA, he talks about concerns in the CIA that getting into drone campaign is really distracting the agency and is shifting its culture away from what it should be, which is emphasizing its two core missions of espionage and intelligence analysis. Colby sort of analogously comes out of, I mean, he's a cold warrior with the emphasis on the warrior part, if I understand you. You indicated that he'd had some concern about the negative effects that Angleton had on the espionage mission when Colby became DCI. So he was paid attention to there. Do you have any sense of the degree to which he really emphasized or thought that the analytic function of the agency was important? Did he get himself involved in that? Did he really sort of care about intelligence analysis as another core mission?
Yeah, I'll tell you the most telling thing that Colby said in this regard was he met Leonid Brezhnev, and he was introduced to Brezhnev as DCI, and Brezhnev said, "Oh, should I be afraid of you?" And Colby said, "Mr. Chairman, your country, my country, the more we know about each other, the safer we are." That's from a head of intelligence. The more we know about each other, the safer we are. And that's a mindset about as far from Jim Angleton's as you can imagine. What Colby objected to, and he was getting support from the Soviet and East European bloc, was that you've got to take chances. The only way you're going to gather intelligence, human intelligence, is if you subvert the other side. If you get defectors, that's how it works. But if you're so terrified of your own operation being penetrated, you can't recruit anybody. And under Angleton, he said that's what was happening. The other problem he had with Angleton was Angleton ran the Israeli desk by himself. I mean, counterintelligence ran the Israeli desk. I mean, there was a Middle East desk, and then there was Angleton's operation. Colby believed in espionage and intelligence gathering, but his problem with Angleton was that this emphasis on counterintelligence was dominating everything. Now, I don't know about I don't know anything about the currency. I don't know anything. I'm an historian. I don't know anything past what happened in 1970. You know, but Petraeus worked for Colby. David Petraeus was Cords. And for years and years and years, unconventional warfare has never been popular with the regular military. Never been popular, and Vietnam is certainly not popular. I mean, for 25 or 30 years, people at West Point or in the Pentagon or planners, they didn't want to hear about Vietnam. Vietnam was a disaster. They didn't want to hear about it. Well. That's only if you believe the war ended in 1968. But I talked to these Cards people who for years and years nobody paid any attention to, and the last 5 or 6 years, they're hot stuff. You know, they're beginning to be invited to conferences and planning sessions and that sort of thing. And one of the things I argue is that I'm aware of the way of the knife or whatever, yeah. The precursor for the drone program is the Phoenix program. This is the same damn thing. It's just different techniques for killing people. It's the same thing. You gather, Joe Biden and others have argued that that's the way that we fight, that we're going to deal with Al-Qaeda, with extremists, with terrorists. That's one of the vet lessons of Vietnam. If you think we're going to rebuild Afghanistan, if you think we're going to actually convert Afghanistan into South Korea, you've got another think coming, particularly if we want to balance a budget. And so the idea is to identify our enemies and to neutralize them. And that's what the Phoenix program is all about. And that's what the drone program is all about, except the means by which you use to kill your enemy is different.
In the back here, Hayden.
Sorry.
Thank you.
How did you come to write a book on Bill Colby?
That's a good question. I guess, at least to me it is. I did a biography of Lyndon Johnson, and I teach a course on Vietnam, and I read a lot about Vietnam. Well, I did a book on Bill Fulbright, and came at it from that angle. And again, so much of the literature has, until 5 or 6 years ago, nearly all the literature focused on the period up until 1968. And I became aware of this massive effort, American effort in Vietnam after 68 and between 72, the so-called other war, counterinsurgency and pacification. And that's how I ran across Colby. And he seemed to me to be an interesting man. To a biography, you've got the person has to have some complexity, he has to be enigmatic, some incongruities. And Colby's a man of he's a Catholic. He's a liberal in a traditional sense. He's a great respecter of the Constitution, but he lived in an environment which had no external controls, in which for many years was an environment in which people made their own rules, lived by their own standards, the activities of the agency where he worked for moved back and forth across moral and legal boundaries, particularly moral and legal boundaries that he'd set up for himself to live by. How did he deal with that? Did it create any conflict? So from a biographer standpoint, I think that's very, very interesting. I didn't decide that I could do the biography. I mean, dealing with a CIA person is very difficult, as you well know. I mean, you can't expect the agency to. It is what it is. It keeps secrets. It people lead double lives. Colby was a man who lived a created life. Lyndon Johnson and Bill Fulbright, they didn't have any secrets. They're out there, they had letters and speeches and that sort of thing. Colby, it wasn't until his family agreed to cooperate with me that I really thought that I could write a biography. It's not as satisfactory. It's as good as I can make it, but it's not as good as it could be. Simply because there's still aspects of the man's personality that nobody will ever know. Although he had this famous, do you know Oriana Fallaci, the communist firebrand journalist, Italian journalist? She hated Colby, and she interviewed him I don't know whether he was still DCI or was out, but she was saying, "You're trying to overthrow undermine our government, destroy us, national self-determination." And he was defending himself. And he looked up at her and he said, "Don't look at me that way." He said, I'm what you see is what you get here. I'm not somebody else. What I'm telling you is the truth." And I think that. Maybe he's not as complicated as he seemed, but I don't have insight into. I can imagine the conflict that he experienced, but I can't. It's difficult to document it.
Any other questions? Right here.
Sorry. What about
contact did you have with his wife and children in writing this book?
Well, they were very cooperative. As I said, they didn't. John Prados wrote a book on Bill Colby, and it's good research. But it's there's no family cooperation, and they hadn't cooperated with anybody. And so I approached them. I tried to approach them, and I didn't have any luck. And I was teaching in Buenos Aires, and I got an email from Bridge Colby, who's an analyst for the Pentagon, their grandson, and said, we've thought about this, and we'd like you to do this. Now, they exercise no control. It's not an authorized biography, as you will see if you read it. But without their cooperation, I couldn't have done it. But they're three sons and one surviving daughter and two wives, and they were all very, very cooperative. So.
Well, let's all thank Randall Woods for a fascinating talk.
I hope you enjoyed this author debriefing. We'd like to know if you have any questions or comments about it. You can get in touch with us through email at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. We look forward to you joining us again for another of our author debriefings, and thanks for listening.